Hello, everybody, and welcome to a brand spanking new episode of Back to Basics. And I use the term spanking because we're talking about all sorts of sexual deviancy once again this week. So, yay! Consider
disclaimer,
this your...
There's nothing wrong with spanking.
Yeah, not a damn thing. At least in the context of consenting adults.
Yeah, safe, sane, and consensual.
Yeah,
right. Exactly. Anyway, let's move along.
So consider,
but it's going to be one of those episodes, guys.
Consider that your warning that this episode is going to be just as much NSFW fun as the last one, because the whole of the chapter we are going through, which is chapter 38 of Genesis, has to do with Tamar getting her freak on in a bunch of different ways. Not always consensually, not always as, you know, the aggressor, sometimes as the victim. Like, there's a lot of stuff going on here. And this one today is going to open us up to some interesting questions about agency. And I think that they're kind of important for us to discuss, because on first read, you're going to be like, the hell, Tamar. But as we get into it, you're going to be like, oh, that's the hell, Tamar. So
okay.
without any further ado or time spent listening to me, dear Courtney, would you like to take us away with Genesis chapter 38, beginning from verse 12? Which is where we left off last week.
Ah, yes. Beginning from verse 12. Okay. In course of time, the wife of Judah, Shua's daughter, died. When Judah's time of mourning was over, he went up to Timnah to his sheep shearers, he and his friend Hira the Adullamite. When Tamar was told, "Your father-in-law is going up to Timnah to shear his sheep," she put off her widow's garments, put on a veil, wrapped herself up, and sat down at the entrance of Enaim, which is on the road to Timnah. She saw that Shelah was grown up, yet she had not been given to him in marriage. When Judah saw her, he thought her to be a prostitute, for she had covered her face. He went over to her at the roadside and said, "Come, let me come in to you," for he did not know that she was his daughter-in-law. She said, "What will you give me that you may come in to me?" He answered, "I will send you a kid from the flock." And she said, "Only if you give me a pledge until you send it." He said, "What pledge shall I give you?" She replied, "Your signet and your cord and the staff that is in your hand." So he gave them to her and went in to her, and she conceived by him. Then she got up and went away, and taking off her veil, she put on the garments of her widowhood. When Judah sent the kid by his friend, the Adullamite, to recover the pledge from the woman, he could not find her. He asked the townspeople, "Where is the prostitute who was at Enaim by the wayside?" But they said, "No prostitute has been here." So he returned to Judah and said, "I have not found her. Moreover, the townspeople said, 'No prostitute has been here.'" Judah replied, "Let her keep the things as her own. Otherwise, we will be laughed at. You see, I sent this kid, and you could not find her." About 3 months later, Judah was told, "Your daughter-in-law Tamar has prostituted herself. Moreover, she is pregnant as a result of prostitution." And Judah said, "Bring her out and let her be burned." As she was being brought out, she sent word to her father-in-law, "It was the owner of these who made me pregnant." And she said, "Take note, please, whose these are, the signet and the cord and the staff." Then Judah acknowledged them and said, "She is more in the right than I, since I did not give her to my son Shelah." And he did not lie with her again. When the time for delivery came, there were twins in her womb. While she was in labor, one put out a hand, and the midwife took and bound on his hand a crimson thread, saying, "This one came out first." But just then he drew back his hand, and out came his brother. And she said, "What a breach you have made for yourself." Therefore he was named Perez. Afterward, his brother came out with the crimson thread on his hand, and he was named Zerah. This is a weird one. I'm not going to lie to you.
This is a weird one. Now, before we get into the actual narrative of it, I want to share a couple of linguistic notes that aren't going to change the weirdness of the narrative yet, but are definitely going to make you go, huh. One of the biggest ones is the fact that in most of our translations here, it keeps referring to her as a prostitute who is prostituting prostitutely. But it actually uses a number of different words for it as the story progresses. So back at the beginning, I'm going to use Alter's translation again, because he's a little more specific on that. In verse kind of 15, 16, it says, "And Judah saw her, and he took her for a whore," Like, it's just blunt about that. And the whole exchange with Judah and the fucking associated with it is exactly that blunt. But later on,
it doesn't mention it was because she had covered her face or.
Yeah, I mean, that's all like, mentioned. That still was the there. Like, yeah, like the verses are still content wise the same. But the word choice of whore rather than prostitute is noteworthy there because Judah's being super blunt about the whole thing. Mm-hmm. Like, he's not being euphemistic at all. And to be perfectly honest,
using a term that's laden with disrespect.
Yeah. Let's be perfectly honest about Judah in verse 13. Look, your father-in-law is going up to Timnah to shear his sheep. Yeah, that's bordering on euphemistic as it is, particularly because sheep shearing is not like, he's not going up there to do something. Sheep shearing is kind of like local festival having. Like, he's going up there to fucking party.
Like, yeah.
Party in the front, party in the back, shear the whole thing, and let's get to town. Like, that's what he was doing here. So that whole thing is meant to be super blunt, but later on when he starts asking after, hey, where is the woman I fucked? He starts asking, where is the cult harlot? Which is from the term, let me read from his notes here. Hira substitutes the more decorous term, Kedeshaha. Or Kedeshah, that's what it is. Yeah, Kedeshah, which is a woman who practices ritual prostitution in a fertility cult, whereas Judah earlier used the term Zona, which is just whore. So, you know, Hiram's being much more...
So even his internal story here seems to kind of keep changing.
A little bit here. Yeah, a little bit here. Like, that is kind of, a big change in perspective here. And they're not kind of messing around with that. Like, in either case, that's a thing that happens. But we see these kind of language changes happening in the text repeatedly, where, like, okay, at this point, whore, at this point, cult, harlot. And it's not represented in the English at all. It's all just, like I said, prostitute, prostituting, prostitutally, which I love that. I love that phrase that I have coined. I'm going to keep using it. So there is, as I always try to remind people, there is an emotional nuance to the original text that is not represented in more accurate English translations, even the more accurate translations, especially the more accurate English translations, if you don't mind my Garrick face here for a moment. So that's my kind of thing. So having put that out there, anything you want to pick at in this crazy clown shoes bonkers story?
Okay, so admittedly it's been a minute since we did the last ones, but why is any of this happening? Like, can you give me a rundown on why?
Well, because women are effectively property for their childbearing ability.
So if you weaponize that childbearing ability, you can get something that you want, and she wanted this?
That is what it looks like on first read, right? Like she wanted to get herself knocked up, so she tricked Judah into fucking her and got herself knocked up. And then when he got pissed about it, she had the receipts. Like, that's what it looks like, right?
Mm-hmm.
But I want to bring back verse 11 here. And I'll read it out of the NRSV here, which is just before the start of today's passage, the end of last week. Then Judah said to his daughter-in-law Tamar, remain a widow in your father's house until my son Shelah grows up, for he feared that he too would die like his brothers. So Tamar went to live in her father's house. Now, I'm going to read Alter's notes on that particular verse, because that gives shitload of context as to what's going on here. So stay a widow in your father's house. The childless Tamar is not only neglected, but must submit to a form of social disgrace in having to return to her father's house after having been twice married. Since enough time elapses for Shelah to grow from pre-puberty to at least late adolescence, see verse 14, this period of enforced return to the status of an unmarried daughter proves to be a very long one. Amos Funkenstein, who's apparently a theologian here, has observed to me that Tamar remains silent in the face of her father-in-law.
Did you just say Funkenstein?
That is the name that is given here in the notes, yes. It's not one that I'm familiar with. I'm presuming it's a Jewish theologian of some note, but it's not one I know. But of note enough to be referenced in Alter's notes. So props on the awesome name.
Funkenstein.
F-U-N-K-E-N-S-T-E-I-N. Funkenstein. That is the best name. I'm not okay right now. Like, that's almost better than the actual Bible bits we're reading. I don't know this person, this theologian. It obviously of note enough to be referenced in Alter's notes, so must be a Jewish theologian of some renown, but I don't know him. But so all I can really say is, I'm sure you know your stuff if you're here, but congrats on having the best name ever. Moving along.
Yeah, sorry, that it hit me over the head pretty hard. Yeah,
no, that's fair. Anyway. So our funky dude has observed that Tamar remains silent in the face of her father-in-law's condemnation, saying nothing of Onan's sexual aberration, and leaving Judah to suppose that the death of both sons is somehow her fault. And although he banishes her to her father's house, she evidently remains under his legal jurisdiction, as his issuing of a death sentence against her later indicates. So...
She felt entitled to defer because she didn't do anything wrong to marry the next kid.
Yeah.
When he came of age, and he came of age. Yeah, because it says in 14, part two, it says she saw that Shelah was grown up, yet she had not been given to him in marriage.
Yep. Like, because that was the expectation. Remember, that's what got Onan in trouble, and that's what got his ass killed. Was the first one died just because death happens. The second one died because he committed rape by fraud. The third one, by culture, was supposed to do what Onan was supposed to do, to either marry his sister-in-law or at least produce a child with her. And Judah was like, yeah, no, fuck that. You've already gone through two of my kids. I'm not putting a third up on you. And that was it. So she's like, well, shit, now I'm stuck here. I'm reduced to this position of an unmarried child in my father's house, but still under Judah's jurisdiction because bullshit reasons. So... I got to do something. Otherwise, I'm going to be stuck like this for the rest of my life, and I'm going to get nothing. Because that she basically got trapped in a legal paradox in society. So suddenly, her going out to basically baby trap Judah makes a hell of a lot more sense, doesn't it?
She's more in the right than I, since I did not give her to my son, Shelah.
Yeah.
Or Shelah.
I mean, credit where it's due to Judah at the end. Like, at the end, at least, because he does some fucked up shit in the middle. But...
Did he realize... Now, is there any indication in the notes or the text? Like, did he realize before she bust out his shit and is like, hey, I got receipts right here. Is this yours? Like, did he realize before that was her?
There is no indication that he does. Like, and in fact, the story goes to great.
So it comes off as the second that he receives and realizes what happened. He's like, "Well, I think I played myself. I think I played myself here."
Yeah,
I can't blame you.
I'm going to read well from played. All his notes on verse 26 again to really put the exclamation mark on that. She is more right than I. The verb used. Sadak is a legal term. It is she who has presented the convincing evidence. But in the next clause, Judah also concedes that he has behaved unjustly towards Tamar, so that, in a sense, her taking the law into her own hands, however unconventional the act, is vindicated by his words. Like, she's straight up, because again...
He's like, no, never mind, I don't want to press charges.
Well, yeah, because she fucking legally outmaneuvered him. Like, there's a legality to sexual contract in this era. Like, it's not just simply, like, baby mama drama here. This is, like, there is a legality to heiressness and, like, sexual interactions and stuff like that. Like, she tricked him. She tricked him hard, but, like...
Does it, like, are we going to find out, did this work out for her?
Seems to have so far. Like, I...
So far, all Joseph... we know is that she successfully survived the delivery, which, at that time, good on ya.
I'm not... I'll admit... I don't recall if this comes back or not. We're dealing with more minor characters than the ones we typically all pay attention to. I don't remember if she comes back or not. I know that from here, we're going into Joseph again for a number of chapters. So this interlude ends here.
That's right. This was an interlude. Dang.
Yeah. So she...
So now I'm like interested in where that goes, but...
Yeah. Narratively speaking, Tamar got hers in the end. And I gotta love it that she got hers by a demonstration of bold sexual agency.
I love that she did it by exploiting, like, the weird flaws in the system.
Note this, by the way, is she never
didn't Judah legally do her wrong by there no way for, like, her or her father to seek any kind of repercussions because she didn't do anything wrong?
I'm going to take a couple of liberties here and reserve the right to be wrong about my interpretation of ancient culture here.
Fair.
So for all of you Jewish theologians here of great note that are following our program, feel free to correct me on this if my understanding here is wrong.
Also, but please come on the show.
Yes, please. For the love of God, that would be wonderful. Anyway, my read here, as I look at the interaction between Judah and Tamar, that includes the fucking, this interaction here, he assumes she is a prostitute and acts accordingly. She doesn't actually say that.
She doesn't approach him. She just dresses a certain way and sits in a certain place. And he's like, well, let's bone.
Yeah. And he makes monetary offers to her, which...
After the fact, was that customary? That seems like a great way to get screwed over, no pun intended. For the prostitutes at the time.
Let's see. He turned aside to her by the road and he said, here, let me come to bed with you. For he knew not that she was his daughter-in-law. And she said, what will you give me for coming to bed with me? So they negotiate.
Oh, okay. They did negotiate it beforehand.
Then they fuck. So, yeah. So that all happens. Right. But this is the piece that maybe questionable.
Technically, yes, she was a prostitute at least at that moment.
Here's the thing. This is not dissimilar from how we would negotiate to take a wife.
What?
Because remember, we've seen people taking a wife just by going to town, finding a pretty girl, and trading her some shit so that she could come join your harem. Like, it's not dissimilar. So the fact that she never said she was a prostitute and he assumed, legally, I believe, that the assumption could be, her legal defense could be, hey, I thought you were trying to take me as a wife. Seemed like a reasonable bargain, like a kid. Like,
if he didn't want me to marry his son, why not take me as a wife?
Exactly. I've gone through two husbands already. My purchase price ain't that high. Like, I'm getting on in years. Seemed reasonable. Yeah, seemed legit. So, like, she has, by this setup, by not claiming to be a prostitute, she was dressed seductively and he made an offer. All right, sounds like he needed another wife. Neither of them are particularly explicit in what they assume the other's doing. And so
that entire batshit situation of, if I just go dress with a face veil and sit in this area,
yeah,
I think this will work. And he'll just, there was nothing weird about that interaction then?
Not necessarily. Like, it wasn't uncommon.
Except for that she was tricking him. There was nothing
except for
that.
For that she was, she was pulling some baby mama drama here. Yeah, other than that, no, it wasn't especially weird. Like, it wasn't uncommon.
I feel like that's important to know about this because the whole story seems so crazy. And knowing that part is pretty common, like, pretty mundane.
Like, there's a reason why... There's a reason why there is a specific term for ritual cult whores here, like particular fertility cult priestess whores. Like, there's a specific term for that for a reason. Like, that was a thing that happened in those days. And men, particularly widowed men, wander into town and be like, all right, you're wearing a veil. You must be one of them. So want to bone down?
And God hadn't said he had a problem with this at any point.
No. Like, as you may have noticed, and as I may have repeated about 750,000 times since we've started, as long as consent is on the table, God does not give a shit what you stick your dick and or other parts into.
Honestly, what I thought he would have the bigger problem with is, like the banging cult members business.
Not particularly. Like,
if it was done ritualistic, I don't know ancient religions. I don't know why I'm assuming.
This is something we'll probably get into as we get into, like, later parts of Genesis and on into, like, later parts of the Old Testament as well. There are a lot of places where we get, like, don't intermingle with non-believers and shit like that.
Yeah.
Most of which is presented as, well, God said this, which is really, like, suggesting more like maybe God said something else and the people interpreted that way, or it was something that was set for a very narrow application and that everyone just kind of takes as being broad. Generally speaking, God doesn't have a problem with, you know, us boning people of other faiths or other perspectives or things like that. That's not really a concern. It comes up from time to time, either because man-made rules or because God has like a narrow contextual application for it in this moment. Like it comes up during the Exodus when they're wandering alone as a tribe in the desert, trying to hold shit together. Okay. I get it there. Like within that narrow context, sure. Don't go banging members outside the tribe because we need to keep our own numbers up because we almost dead. Okay.
Yeah, you start banging people outside the tribe while you're trying to find a place, and like 40 numbers years later, start declining as these people drop off here and these people drop off here, and suddenly.
Right. Yeah. So, which is, again, one of the many reasons I tell people context is fucking important with this stuff.
Honestly, I think it's really I mean, again, to reiterate what we said as a joke earlier and what I know I've said at some point in the series earlier on, like, if you were an interested, like, you know, experienced, knowledgeable Jewish theologian who would like to come on here and like school our asses about Jewish culture at this time, please do. Like, we would love to know more. Desire to know more increases.
One thing I will throw out too as well that is worth noting is that even amongst Jewish theologians, there are differing opinions for how this stuff is meant to be understood, just as many as there are among Christians. Like, there is no unified kind of monolithic Jewish understanding of Old Testament texts. Like
how much room for, just like in your professional opinion though, how much room for interpretation idea really from a Christian angle at least is there? Because like I always hammer about this, I feel like there are facts, and no, there are not like alternative facts to that. Like these are harder to dig up facts, I feel like, because despite having the book, this stuff is really 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 old, and was really old before it was written. You might have noticed we got carried away again.
Yeah, we do that. So we're gonna stop here for today and continue this where we left off in next week's episode, because holy shit, we had a lot to say on this one. Like, there's a lot going on here. So I'm gonna say we're pausing for now. Thanks for sticking with us. Join us next week for the exciting conclusion of Tamar and the sexual escapades that go crazy. It's fun stuff. In the meantime, Discord server is a thing. We are continuing the conversation there. And oh boy, is it a conversation. We've got fellowship. We've got memes. We've got prayer. We got a whole bunch of stuff going on there. Please come join us in the place doing the things. I would really hope we'll see you there. It's fun. We've got a new member class. We've got monthly worship services. We got a monthly Bible study that is rocking through the book of Revelation and discovering some weird shit about that. Go figure. That book, weird? Who'd have guessed? So come join us for all of the things. We'd love to have you there. And if you can't do anything else, at least you can do what Courtney asks of you, which is...
like, share, and subscribe.
Yay!
But seriously, join the Revelation Bible study. I've only shown up like once, and it was an absolute blast.
Oh yeah. So, yeah, we
actually have fun talking about the Bible. Oh, it's God, not yes. illegal in mm-hmm. fact to laugh at the Bible and be like, what the fuck is this here?
Yeah, it's literally Super Saiyan Jesus. What the hell? That's a thing that happened.
Oh gosh, I forget. I need to show up more often for Bible study. That's so freaking fun. As you may have noticed from our like rolled together asses, like, you don't have to be perfect to go to church. You don't have to be anything in particular. You don't even really have to be Christian to come join up and talk with us at Unfinished. Like, if you're gonna join the church, yes, but like, if you want to come talk about some shit and not have people being like, so when can we baptize you, like, no, come learn, come talk, you know, like, it's okay. It's not this separate
if
thing.
You want a dunk or a splash, I got one for you, but you ain't needed to show up.
Yeah, if you just want to learn, that's okay. There's nothing, of the wild opinion that there's nothing wrong with that. And yeah, if you want to learn about what Christianity is about, pop into a church, and we don't care if you don't believe in Jesus. We'll hang out with you anyway. We'll talk to you. If you've shown up, we'll kind of assume that you want to hear what we think. Yeah. To a certain extent, But yeah, don't expect to crash the party and burn the house down. We will take issue with that. And Don gets meaner than I do in comments.
I do have a band hammer, but I've only had to use it, I think, maybe once on a bot. So, you know, if you want to put that to the test, good luck. But
we don't need to make the outro longer than the episode. So I apologize for
going. It's a good point. We've got a good server. We want to see people there, Christian or not. Everybody is welcome, and we're not going to pester you about random bullshit. Like, you want to be there, be there. You don't want to be there, don't be there. We're just happy if you show up.
Just know that if you're interested in checking it out, you're welcome.
Yeah, exactly. So in the meantime, do the like, share, and subscribe, as Courtney has asked, and have yourself a great week, and we will see you on the exciting conclusion next week. Bye, everybody.
Bye.